Nothing new to learn about the Budweiser the beer, but if you just watch or listen or read for a minute, you'll be entertained. And you may even keep yourself from being out of the loop when people are chatting about it next week around the water cooler. One last thing to consider as you plan a communication campaign, give yourself room for evolution if the campaign actually gains some traction. Even the best love ads get tiresome with sufficient viewing. In order to keep people's attention, it's often necessary to change things up a bit to refresh the idea. Some campaigns are flexible enough to do this in ways that hold true to the original goals, but are still different enough to keep customers engaged. And here's one of the best ways to do this. Don't simply create a single piece of communication, or even a single set of communications. Instead, consider establishing a template for communicating with your target customers. A template that allows you to make changes in ways that make sense. This advice holds for all types of communications, whether advertising or email communications, or direct mail catalogs or PR campaigns. Early on, you should develop a theme for those types of communications. What is it about the messaging that's core and should remain immutable? And what should be free to change over time? Among print advertisers, Absolut Vodka is perhaps the best example of a company doing templates well. For years, their print ads featured some visual riff on their iconic bottle, which took up most of the page. Could be a bottle made out of flowers, or the shadow of a bottle across a town square, or a skyscraper shaped like the bottle, or ski runs in a mountain that are shaped like the bottle. The formula allowed for endless reinvention. Almost anything could be photographed or photoshopped to accommodate the Absolut bottle. So the ads never got old, and they always attracted attention while remaining consistent. An example of an ad campaign that I think evolved poorly is the Capital One Visa card commercials. The campaign started off well enough. The original ads featured someone in a setting where they were about to use a credit card. For example, one of the ads showed some guy dining out. The waiter brings the bill, the diner reaches into his wallet, and then the voiceover reminds us of the dangers of using a credit card. Everything from fraud to stolen identities to high fees. As we are reminded of the financial perils, we see a barbarian horde descending on this hapless consumer. They're charging down the street where the restaurant is located, dented armor and animal hides hanging off of them, axes and clubs at the ready. Then, just as they're about to reach the consumer, he pulls out the Capital One Visa card. The barbarians are immediately deflated. They stop their axes mid-swing, they slump their shoulders, they turn around, and they go home. And the ad ends with the menacing tagline, "What's in your wallet?" This is a great positioning for a very crowded credit card market. Capital One protects you. And the creative was brilliant in getting that message across. I loved the initial ads. But then, over time, the focus of the campaign shifted. Instead of being symbolic of the dangers inherent in financial transactions, the barbarians became spokesmen for the card. Instead of descending menacingly on some poor everyman about to make a purchase, the barbarians themselves were the ones actually using the card to make purchases. Now it was these Visigoths who were charging things to the Capital One card so they could rack up points to go on vacation to the Grand Canyon. They were customizing the cards with pictures of their barbarian children. Now the barbarians were using their Capital One cards to pay for festive family reunions where they would engage in beard-growing contests with Alec Baldwin. What is happening here? Did I just have a stroke? How is any of this supposed to make sense to the average consumer? Why are barbarians using this brand of credit card? And more importantly, why should I care? It's been long enough ago now that TV watchers who are not, you know, marketing professors probably don't even remember the original commercials. So for most people, there's no link. There's no explanation for why the Capital One card is being used by unwashed men carrying swords, and wearing bearskins and dented helmets. This campaign evolved poorly because it didn't follow a template. Instead, it established a central character and simply let the wheels spin from there. The result is kind of a mess from the customer's perspective. Designing and running a marketing campaign can be intimidating, but there is a process to marketing communications, just like anything else. The first thing you have to do is make sure you have a goal for this communication. This is true whether you're running a Super Bowl ad or something much simpler, like passing out a flyer, designing a website, or sponsoring an event. You should always know what is the problem I am trying to solve with this communication. What do I want to change with this? In this lecture, we talked a lot about some general strategies for marketing campaigns. And these would be applicable to any specific communication medium used, whether TV or radio or billboards or flyers, whatever. In the next lecture, we'll continue our discussion of communication by digging a little more into the specific opportunities and challenges associated with social media and word-of-mouth communications.
This lecture is titled, The Promise and Perils of Social Media.
In the last lecture, we talked about communications as a tactic. The principles we discussed in that lecture will hold for all your communications efforts, whether traditional advertising or direct mail or website design. You should always know who your target customer is for that particular communication effort, and you should always customize your communication effort to provide value for that target customer. But even though the general rules we covered last time apply to all forms of communication with the customer, I think it's worth spending some time talking about some of the newer, let's call them non-traditional, means of communication that marketers now have at their disposal. Social media, word-of-mouth campaigns, viral videos. There's lots of new and innovative ways of getting information to your customers. But there are also some additional challenges when using non-traditional communications. In contrast to traditional advertising, which was a direct mode of communicating to customers, many of these new communication channels provide less in the way of control over the message. Specifically, these forms of communication typically reach consumers only indirectly, through some intermediary, such as a reporter or a friend. As a result, these non-traditional indirect modes of communication effectively add another layer of customers who need to be served by the communication if it's to succeed. Let me illustrate this general concern by talking about one of the oldest and best established means of non-advertising communication, public relations. Many firms do PR, but few do it well. And often, it goes wrong for the same reasons. Companies love public relations. After all, aside from whatever you're paying your PR firm or the person who's writing the press release, it's free. What could be better than getting your message out in a national publication or broadcast at little or no cost to you? So, most companies try to get attention from the press, and they mostly go about it in the same way, a press release. Here's our big announcement. Here's a quote from the president of the company telling everyone how proud we are of this achievement. Here's a quote from a happy customer saying how excited they are by this big announcement. And done. Attach to an email, send it off to every reporter in the contact list, and just wait for all of that free publicity to come rolling in, right? But then the days go by, and the New York Times still is not called asking for additional quotes for the front page story you were sure they'd be writing about your new product release. What went wrong? Why do so many press releases just disappear into the ether? The problem is that companies simply forget who the customer is. In the case of public relations, the press is the customer. The reporters, the cable news producers, the industry trade writers, they are the customers that you need to try to serve with your public relations campaigns. Far too many companies are completely centered on themselves when they engage in PR efforts. They try to tell reporters about what the company is excited about. And guess what? Reporters don't care. And why should they? If you want your PR to take off, you have to give reporters something that they will be interested in writing about. Think about the stories reporters might be trying to write. Provide them with your message in a way that resonates with the stories they're already working on. For example, if the country is in the midst of an economic downturn, there are probably reporters looking for stories on green shoots in the economy, evidence that things might be picking up. So instead of just sending out a generic story about your new product launch, contact those reporters who would be most likely to write those "the economy might be on an upswing" types of stories, and pitch them your story as an example of a green shoot. Did your new product launch allow you to hire more people or add another shift? Are you opening a new factory that will create jobs? Those are the types of things the reporter will be interested in. That's the hook that you can get a reporter to tell your story to potential customers. Remember, to serve those reporters and producers and writers as customers, figure out what they value and give that to them. That's when your PR efforts will be most successful. Take one of the most astounding successes in recent public relations history, American Giant. This is a small, independent sweatshirt maker in San Francisco. They wanted to promote their products, which they boldly claim are the world's best hooded sweatshirts. If they were a typical company, American Giant would have written up a press release telling the world just how great their sweatshirts are, including a few customer testimonials, some pictures of the sweatshirts, send it off, and hope for the best. If they were really savvy, they may have targeted their press release to, say, fashion reporters, instead of just any old reporter. They didn't do either of these things. Instead, American Giant contacted Farhad Manju, a technology columnist writing for Slate. Let's pause here and let that sink in a bit. A sweatshirt maker contacted a technology columnist to pitch their story. Why in the world? Well, first of all, they knew their target customers, the people who would end up buying and wearing high-end sweatshirts, were likely to be well represented in Mr. Manju's readership at Slate. Whereas, even if they had been successful in getting some fashion reporter to write up a short blurb about how slick and fashionable these zip-up hoodies are, yeah, no one who would actually buy a hoodie is going to seek out and read an article in the fashion pages, are they? But even more important, American Giant knew that a story about a cool hoodie would be an awfully hard sell anywhere, to anyone. Hoodies just aren't that exciting, even the best ones in the world. But where the story of the hoodie itself might not be that exciting, American Giant had a story of business and manufacturing innovation that someone like a technology columnist might find very interesting indeed. And Mr. Manju did. On December 4th, 2012, Manju published his usual column in Slate about this unusual apparel. What had really fascinated him was the way American Giant was using the internet to sell direct to the customer, bypassing the distribution costs that most apparel makers face. Manju reported that American Giant, quote, had figured out a way to do what most people in the apparel industry consider impossible, making clothes entirely in the United States and doing so at costs that aren't prohibitive. Now that is a story worth writing a column about. In the course of telling this story about the company, of course, Manju also informed readers about the products themselves. He told readers that American Giant had redesigned their hoodies from scratch, using different materials and an innovative design. He noted that they had even, quote, hired a former industrial designer from Apple to rethink every aspect of the sweatshirt, from the way the fabric is woven to the color of the drawstrings around your neck. They had essentially treated the sweatshirt as if it were a tech product, testing endless prototypes until they were satisfied. Are you starting to see why a technology columnist might love to sink his teeth into this one? In fact, Manju's piece was a gushing tribute to the sweatshirts and to the company that made them. You simply could not buy press this good. The column was even titled, "This is the greatest hoodie ever made." And it went viral almost immediately. It was tweeted and retweeted and emailed and posted on Facebook. The story was picked up by ABC and NPR. At the time the article ran in early December, American Giant was struggling to generate sales. The company's founder had just received word from his operations manager that they'd overbought for the holiday season and they were facing too much inventory. They were looking at possibly having to pull back on production runs at the start of the new year. Things were looking a little bleak. And then the Slate piece broke, and within 36 hours, everything changed. The company's management got a call from their e-commerce team, something about needing to rebalance the servers to handle the load. As they were talking, the guy from e-commerce said, Dude, I don't know if you understand what's happening. In the last minute that we've spoken, 55 orders have come in. They sold everything they had in inventory. They sold pre-orders for what they had planned to make in January, and then February, and then March. Soon, the company was no longer able to even commit to a time frame for delivery, promising only that they would ramp up as quickly as they could to handle the demand. Wait times extended to more than half a year, and still people waited, wanting their very own best hoodie ever made. The difference between American Giant's astonishing PR success and the deafening silence that most firms reap comes from applying the same basic marketing principles we've been talking about throughout the entire course. Recognize who your customer is. For public relations campaigns, the reporter or the columnist or the producer, that's the customer. This insight into what makes PR campaigns work is also the key to getting viral campaigns to take off. Viral marketing has been a common tactic for several years now, commonly tried, I should say. The idea is to create something, an online video, a web game, a clever tweet, an op-ed, or even just an experience or story, something that people will find sufficiently worthy that they will forward it to others or talk to others about it. These friends and families will then push that content onto others, and the marketing message will spread like a virus until it has infected the whole market. As you can imagine, however, getting viral marketing to work is easier said than done. Most often, when a company or ad agency announces its intention of starting a viral campaign, they mean a communication effort that they're not willing to put any money behind. I once heard someone say that viral is just a code word for fueled by prayer. Like successful PR campaigns, successful viral marketing campaigns must serve two customers, or rather, two different customer needs. There must, of course, be the message about the product or service or brand, the marketing message, else why are we doing this in the first place? But there's also that additional social need that must be met with the communication effort. People need to derive some value from sharing the message. Most often, that value comes from amusing others by sharing funny videos or articles. But sometimes people derive value from sharing content that is emotionally moving or profound or insightful or just plain interesting. There are several particular needs that can be met by viral content, but in order for it to be successful, it must meet some social need for those consumers. In other words, customers must gain something, some kind of social utility from sharing the message with others. Just as you should anticipate the value that a reporter might seek to gain from a press release, you should also know exactly what value customers would get from communicating your would-be viral message to others. Once again, what is important to the company getting across the message that will sell the product or service is often not at all important to the customer that you want to spread that message. I saw a great mantra posted on the wall of the Chicago office of the advertising agency Energy BBDO. It was written in the voice of the customer, to remind these advertisers that customers have different motivations than companies. It said, "I tell my friends about your brand, not because I like your brand, but because I like my friends." So the key to viral marketing is this: give your consumers content that they will want to give as gifts to their friends. Another big change in marketing communication over the last few years is the increasing prevalence of destination content. Increasingly, companies are looking to cut through the clutter of advertising by creating on-message content that people actually seek out. One version of this strategy is to just create advertisements that are so entertaining, funny, or moving, or amazing, that people will go online and look for the ads because they hear people talking about them, or because they want to see the ads themselves again. One prominent example was the Volvo truck ad that featured Jean-Claude Van Damme standing on the side mirrors of two moving trucks which slowly drift apart until the action movie star is doing a perfect split between the two trucks rolling down the asphalt. If you sought out that commercial on YouTube, as millions did, then you are familiar with destination marketing. Volvo created something astounding and entertaining as a way of getting its message across, and people responded. In cases like this, only a small fraction of the total viewership comes from airing the ads on television. Most of their reach happens later, online, when customers seek out the advertising content as destination entertainment. But double duty advertising, that is, advertising that is meant to air in traditional media channels and also to be sought out as entertainment in non-traditional channels, this is not the only way to develop destination marketing content. Increasingly, firms are creating entertaining content that is designed to live just online. One of the most prominent examples of this was a series of short films BMW produced and distributed over the internet. Starting in 2001, BMW hired some of the most talented directors from all over the world to make short films featuring BMWs and starring Clive Owen as the driver. The films were written by top Hollywood talent, produced by the likes of David Fincher, Ang Lee, and Ridley and Tony Scott. The series also ran the gamut of styles and tone, from lighthearted slapstick comedy to dark and mysterious noir to tense action drama. And each of the films, as it just so happens, featured a different aspect of the BMW brand and a different set of product features. For example, in one of the first films, the driver was tasked with driving a young boy, the cutest little Buddhist monk you've ever seen, to safety as he was chased through the city by ninja assassins. The film emphasized BMW's safety as the car's driver repeatedly used the car to evade danger and to save the young boy's life. Another film tells the story of the driver being hired to chauffeur a particularly obnoxious singing star, played by Madonna. This movie communicates the young, powerful, fun side of the BMW brand by showing the driver speed recklessly through the streets of LA, tossing the panicked star from side to side in the back seat. The short films were successful in part because they succeeded as films. Time Magazine and the New York Times were among the outlets that lavished praise on the BMW shorts. And because of the quality, these films became destination entertainment. People sought out the movies and watched them and then forwarded them on to friends. The shorts were watched more than 11 million times in the first 4 months after they were launched. But more than just a critical success, the series was also a marketing success. Sales of BMW cars went up a whopping 12% in the year that the films came out. Fine, fine, I hear you saying. Sure, if we can scrape together enough money in our marketing budget this year, we'll just go out and hire Clive Owen and Ang Lee and we'll be set. And fair enough. But pouring money into creating great small-screen cinema is not the only way to create great destination entertainment. You also don't need to be selling something sexy, like a luxury sports car. Let me tell you about a small firm selling an almost prototypically bland product that created destination entertainment on a budget of practically nothing. In 2006, a small specialty blender manufacturer located in Orem, Utah, hired a new marketing director. On one of his first days on the job at BlendTech, he was being taken on a tour of the manufacturing plant, and he heard these terrible grinding, banging noises coming from one of the back rooms. He asked if there was some kind of problem, and the person showing him around said, "Oh no, that's just Tom." Turned out that the company's founder, Tom Dixon, was also the chief engineer, and he would routinely fail test his creations by feeding 2x4s and chunks of metal into the blenders until they would break. He would then take them apart, see why they had failed, and redesign those parts to be better. Which makes perfect sense when someone explains it to you. But it still just looks like a crazy guy putting stuff in a blender that doesn't belong in a blender. And the marketing guy knew he had just struck gold. He went out, bought a cheap webcam, put Tom in a lab coat, gave him an increasingly improbable sample of things to blend. And with that, Will It Blend was born. Each 3 or 4 minute webisode starts with Tom showing some common household object, a bag of marbles, a rake, box of light bulbs, half a dozen Bic lighters, 6-pack of soda, golf balls, a lava lamp, even an iPhone. Tom says something pithy about the object and then asks, "But will it blend? That is the question." And then, together, we find out whether or not it blends. Spoiler alert, most things blend. These short webisodes are bizarre and funny and innovative. And most important, they are entertaining by illustrating exactly how good BlendTech's blenders are at, well, blending. Within a week of posting the first video on YouTube, it had been viewed more than 6 million times. Within 2 years, sales had gone up 700%. The campaign, which remember involved no professional advertising firm, had practically no budget, and was for a blender, won a Clio Award, one of the most prestigious awards in advertising. On the surface, BMW's short films and BlendTech's Will It Blend series seem about as different as marketing communications can get, in terms of budget, star power, brand power. But these very different destination marketing efforts were successful, in my opinion, because they both got a few key principles right. Let's develop a tool for our marketing toolkit that will help in designing destination marketing. First, both BMW and BlendTech created value for the customer by actually being entertaining. That seems basic, but traditional advertising is primarily about delivering the message. And that is completely different from destination marketing, where the entertainment value of the communication must be the primary concern. If people don't choose to go and go back and tell their friends about it, then it won't matter what the message is. So you must create something worth seeking out. But there's a balancing act, of course. And this is the second big point of consideration. Just as an on-point message is useless without the entertainment value to draw people in, creating something that's entertaining without delivering the marketing message is just throwing money away. The third point to consider is the way in which the message is made to be entertaining. What made both of these campaigns successful is that they were able to entertain in a way that emphasized the marketing message. Each BMW film showed the car being powerful, or fun, or elegant, or safe, all the attributes BMW wanted associated with its brand. And each Will It Blend segment showed the blenders happily chewing their way through things that are way tougher than the frozen fruit you'll be using for your smoothies. These campaigns were entertaining in a way that reinforced the message. Let's close with a few words of advice for using social media as a marketing tool. As a communications tactic, social media offers several advantages. First, it's cheap. Much of the word of mouth that companies court nowadays comes in the form of social media word of mouth. Getting customers to tweet about your product or say something about it on Facebook can be very influential to other customers and can cost you very little. Social media also has the advantage of being a two-way communication channel. If you pay attention, you can learn as much from your customers as your customers are learning from each other. Social media is thus part marketing communications and part marketing research. But despite its power, reach, and low cost, there are easy ways to screw up your social media efforts. Let's cover the most common errors companies make. The most common error I see among firms engaging in social media efforts is the failure to base social media strategy on the larger marketing goals of the company. Often, especially when a communications medium is new and not well understood, companies will hire specialists to design and implement their social media strategy. Recent years have seen the rise of waves of specialty firms that do just web communication, or just digital communication, or just mobile communications, or just social media communications. And there's nothing wrong with getting experts involved in helping you meet these new challenges. The problems arise when these groups are largely autonomous from the rest of your marketing efforts. The result is digital or social media campaigns, sometimes very successful campaigns, that don't advance the company's overall marketing strategy. The clearest manifestation of this phenomenon is the obsession with new metrics specific to various websites and platforms. I'm talking about things like a clout score or the number of Facebook likes. Some companies hired digital or social media agencies to create campaigns whose sole purpose was to encourage people to like them on Facebook. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with getting people to like your brand on Facebook. It opens a channel for further communications with those customers. It increases the chances that their friends will see that association and become more interested in the brand. But Facebook likes are not an end unto themselves. Just because they're easy to measure doesn't make them an appropriate metric for a campaign, and certainly not justification for seeking them out. Let me give you an example. In 2010, State Farm launched a Facebook campaign to get people to like them by developing a series of humorous fake advocacy messages. Things like, I'm pro sweaters on animals, or I'm pro underage wizardry. People were encouraged to take their own stands on these fake issues. It was a fun and clever campaign. State Farm wanted more likes on Facebook, and that's what they got. Daily likes increased by almost 600%, and their fan engagement measure increased by almost 300%. All good things. But those likes were almost certainly driven by people who, in fact, liked cats wearing sweaters, and not by people who actually liked State Farm insurance. The messaging, though clever, had nothing to do with the State Farm brand or with the products it sells, which means they were developing a channel for communicating with a specific group of potential customers who had no particular interest in their brand and likely no particular interest in insurance products. They might as well have picked addresses out of the phone book. Contrast that strategy with what Allstate did in bringing their Mayhem campaign over from television advertising into social media spaces. The Mayhem campaign features actor Dean Winters as a disheveled man in a torn suit, standing in for the random acts of nature that cause property damage. The ad campaign has been an enormous success by reminding people, in a humorous way, of all the dangers in the world that insurance can protect you from, or at least pay to fix later. Allstate took this campaign and translated it into the digital world. They gave the Mayhem character a Facebook account and a Twitter account with which he could crack jokes. For example, when the power went out during the 2013 Super Bowl, Mayhem immediately took credit for it on Facebook. People loved it, and the likes and the Twitter followers rolled in. And these people are there specifically because they love the Mayhem campaign. This strengthens the connections in their minds between Allstate and protection every time they get a laugh. So that's the first bit of advice for social media marketing. Don't chase irrelevant metrics. Make sure that whatever you are doing is going to further your specific marketing plan, including reaching your customers with your positioning message. A related bit of advice is to not fall into what I call the shiny object trap. There's a strong bias among some marketers to think that they have to be a part of every new platform, every new medium, every new forum for exchange or communication. These decisions should be made on a case-by-case basis and should depend on things like, do our target customers actually participate in this particular social media platform? Will our target customers be open to our messaging on this platform? If the answers to those questions are no, then there's really no reason to rush into that social network. Perhaps it's not actually necessary to have campaigns running simultaneously on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and Imgur and the dozen other new social media forums that have been developed in the time since I started speaking this sentence. You should always have your eyes open for new opportunities. And if your customers are congregating in some virtual space, you should try to be there. But just because something is new doesn't mean you must rush in or be left behind. In short, virtual spaces are like real spaces. Most companies recognize that their brand should not be everywhere in the real world. There are some things that don't make sense to sponsor, some locations that don't make sense to advertise in. The same is true of virtual spaces. Your brand just doesn't belong everywhere online.
This lecture is titled, Innovative Marketing Research Techniques.
In this course, we've talked about strategy, about knowing who your customer is and what they value. We've also talked about tactics, the mix of marketing variables like price and brand and communication, which you will use to implement your strategy. And throughout, I've mentioned again and again that thoughtful introspection and solid logic can actually get you a long way toward creating a great marketing strategy and developing some solid marketing tactics. And that's true as far as it goes. But I've also mentioned several times throughout the course that whenever possible, you should be basing your decision-making on solid market research. There's simply no substitute for going out and talking to your customers, for observing them in the store or as they use the product, and surveying them about their preferences. Successful companies are those that have marketing research in their DNA. Your customers will constantly surprise you if you take the opportunity to listen to them and watch what they're doing. I thought that marketing research was an appropriate topic to end on because it's most often the place that you'll start. Now that you have an entire course worth of material on the theory of marketing, going out and observing customers is a great place to start in applying those theories to the specific problems you are looking to solve. In order to make the best use of our time, I thought I would focus on some of the marketing research techniques you may be less familiar with. This should not be interpreted as a slight against the old standbys, conducting surveys or analyzing secondary data like sales data or web traffic. These quantitative research methods can yield powerful insights. But you probably already know quite a bit about surveys, having taken roughly a gazillion of them in your lifetime. And digging into the basics of regression analysis necessary to analyze big data is outside the scope of this course. So instead, I'm going to focus on some of the qualitative marketing research methods you may be less familiar with. Qualitative research methods include customer observations, focus groups, ethnographies, and projective techniques. The data produced from qualitative methods are most often expressed in qualitative terms. Stories about typical customer experiences, representative quotes from customers, things like that. Some companies have a culture that embraces qualitative research because they believe these methods produce uniquely useful insights. Consider Procter & Gamble's official research philosophy. Quote, "We live with our consumers and try to see the world and opportunities for new products through their eyes. At P&G, the CEO is not the boss. The consumer is." That living with consumers and seeing the world through their eyes is what qualitative research is all about. You don't get that by conducting some surveys or looking at sales data. The goal of qualitative research is to shed all the baggage that comes from working for a firm, of being involved with the marketing of a product, of understanding all the behind-the-scenes decisions that lead to an offering coming to market, to put all that to the side and to rediscover the offering from the customer's perspective. None of this is to say that qualitative research is superior to quantitative techniques. Qualitative research and quantitative research are not substitutes for each other. Procter & Gamble is also a big proponent of using quantitative research to guide their decisions. But the best scenario is one in which a marketer can make use of many different types of research when making their decisions. Multiple research methods can, and ideally should, be used iteratively, constantly looking for new insights and testing those insights with additional research before starting all over again. When conducting qualitative research, the goal is to develop a rich understanding of your customers in situ, as they shop, as they consume, as they talk to others about your products and services. The output of these qualitative research techniques is often referred to as thick descriptions. They'll often include direct quotes from the customers to illustrate various points. The goal is verisimilitude, an accurate representation of the experience of the customer, capturing the essence by digging into individual experiences and looking for generalizable similarities across individual customer experiences. All right, all of that was very abstract. Let me get more specific by talking about a few of the research methods you can use. The first qualitative method we'll discuss is the most common, the focus group. Focus groups are typically groups of 5 to 10 consumers gathered together for a candid discussion of some topic, product, issue, or even political candidate. Typically, focus groups will consist of just customers who are in the target segment. Focus groups can be a very expensive way to gather information about all possible customer segments. They tend to work better for narrowly defined targets. Focus groups have a discussion leader, either someone from the marketing team or a professional focus group leader, who guides the customer group through a series of questions or tasks. If the focus group was convened to discuss a product, there may be samples there for the group to experience and react to. Historically, focus groups have been held in conference rooms, often with a one-way mirror where interested parties can silently watch the proceedings. More recently, it's become common to conduct these in less formal settings, like someone's home, or even online using video conferencing software. Focus groups are a great method for seeking clarification on some particular idea or question. In other words, focus groups are most effective when they are, well, focused. In this way, focus groups are conceptually similar to surveys. In both cases, consumers are asked a specific set of questions to gain insight into a particular set of topics. Focus groups are inferior to surveys in that the results tend to be less generalizable. After all, you're getting input from only a tiny fraction of those customers that you would typically reach with a survey. But focus groups are superior to surveys in the depth of the information you can get out of participants. Focus groups delve deep. They allow for follow-up questions and more detailed explanations. But both surveys and focus groups are limited in that they are primarily guided by the researcher. The marketer decides which questions to ask and which topics to cover. In this way, surveys and focus groups tend to be bound by the limits of the marketer's imagination. It can be hard to discover radically new and surprising insights if you have to define all the questions that will be asked. Other qualitative research methods are designed to get around this limitation by being more open-ended and less directed by the researcher. The next research method we'll discuss is pretty simple: customer observation. This method just involves watching and listening to customers. The advantage of using observations over surveys or focus groups, where, you know, you just ask people what they're doing and why, is that people don't always know the things that they're doing. Sometimes you can find out some surprising and surprisingly useful things about your customers. Sometimes things they didn't even know about themselves. Let me give you an example. I heard this story from John Sherry, chair of the marketing department at the University of Notre Dame, and one of the pioneers of using qualitative research methods in marketing. Once, a baby food company wanted to figure out how parents were choosing baby foods. So they asked them. They did surveys and focus groups, and they learned some interesting things. Then, they hired people to stand surreptitiously in the baby food aisle and just watch people as they chose baby foods. What they found is that, surprisingly, some of these customers were going through many of the same rituals when picking jars of baby food that they would have gone through when selecting fresh fruit from the produce section. They would pick up the jars and turn them over in their hands, looking at them from all angles, as if looking for bruised spots or damaged areas. They weren't reading the labels when they did this. In fact, they were trying to peer past the label into the green or orange mush inside. They were also squeezing the jars when they picked them up, as if it was a peach, and they were checking for firmness or ripeness or something. On more than one occasion, a customer actually raised the jar to their face and sniffed it. What is going on here? Well, if you'd asked these customers how they chose among baby foods, they would have told you some reasonable-sounding story about how the brand matters and the ingredients, and the nutrition information is, of course, important. And I'm sure all that would have been true. What no one would have told you is that they also squeezed the glass jar and tried to smell the mashed green beans through the lid like a crazy person. But in a crazy sort of way, it kind of makes sense. When buying food for your baby, you're probably motivated to get something that's healthy and nutritious and fresh. But how can you make those assessments of a processed, packaged food? For at least some parents, it appears that there's some subconscious instinct that kicks in and leads them to treat baby food jars like produce. So, now the important question. How was this qualitative research put to use? What did this baby food company do now that they were armed with this information, that their customers were behaving in this strange way? Well, they redesigned the packaging. They made the jars rounder, softening the edges, making them look a little bit less like the industrial glass cylinders that they were, and just a little bit more organic, shaped a little bit more like plums or apples. They also shrunk the labels a bit to make it easier for parents to see inside the jars. Now, why would anyone want a better view of colored mush? I don't know, but apparently these customers did, so the company gave it to them. They also increased the use of pictures of fresh, whole fruits and vegetables on the packaging. Fewer smiling babies eating the food, more pictures of the foods that had been mushed up to make the baby food, since for many customers, that's what was driving purchase. Observations like this can be done live, in stores or restaurants, or if you're selling a piece of equipment in a B2B setting, on factory floors. Wherever your customer is purchasing or consuming your product or service, you can observe them. Just watch and listen and see how they choose those offerings. Typically, this research is conducted formally with a dedicated research team intentionally observing with the goal of generating customer insights, as opposed to just, you know, occasionally asking your employees what they've noticed customers doing. Observational researchers take careful notes immediately when possible, soon after observation when not, and the research teams tend to meet frequently to compare notes and look for insights. What the teams are looking for is common behavior. The most valuable insights are those that apply to a large group of customers. In this era of increased electronic surveillance, many firms can also use observational techniques on recordings of customer interactions. For example, ATMs all have cameras to record transactions. Primarily, these are anti-theft devices, but they also provide millions of hours of recordings of customers interacting with the machines. Banks have been using these recordings for years to try to improve the customer experience in using an ATM. For example, it used to be that all ATMs would start the transaction by sucking your bank card into the machine. In observing the videos, banks noticed that some customers appeared to become very agitated, nervous and uncomfortable by the machine taking their card away from them, even for just a few minutes. The fear, one assumes, is that this cold, impersonal box of gears and electronics will refuse to give the card back, causing a major inconvenience. Banks use that observation to change the way machines interact with customers. Now, most ATMs use a system where customers simply swipe the card and never have to give up possession of it. One of the best-known proponents of observational research methods in marketing is Paco Underhill. His qualitative research has resulted in a number of very interesting observations about the way people shop. For example, he has found that customers generally require a decompression zone when they enter a retail space. Essentially, consumers are completely unaware of any signage or displays or special offers that are placed within the first few feet of a store's front doors. It's as if people need a space to become accustomed to being in the store, to acclimatize. If you try to reach them when they're decompressing, they'll be blind and deaf to your appeals. Another famous Underhill finding is the evocatively named butt brush effect. Basically, people don't like having things or people touch their derrieres when they're in public spaces. It makes them uncomfortable. And when people get uncomfortable, they don't buy stuff. Isn't this too obvious to need saying? Apparently not. As Mr. Underhill documents in some of his books, he found that again and again, retailers would set up displays that required customers to lean forward to examine the merchandise, thereby exposing the rump, and that these displays would frequently be placed in high traffic areas that created an excessive incidence of butt brushing. Observation proved that these displays would not tend to generate much in the way of sales. People might stop briefly, but they would then move on very quickly. Instead, moving these displays out of the flow of traffic would allow people to browse without feeling encroached upon, without feeling like they were about to be attacked from behind, and sales would invariably go up. These insights, and many more like them, are just there for the taking. Just by thoughtfully observing your customers and taking note of what you see. After a while, you'll start to see common experiences, themes, behaviors, or reactions. Another, more interactive form of observational qualitative research is the ethnography. Ethnographies are a research tool developed by cultural anthropologists to understand the cultures, traditions, behaviors, and beliefs of groups of people. Have you ever watched a documentary about a group of researchers probably wearing, you know, khaki vests and a pith helmet who go out to some indigenous tribe in the mountainous jungles of a remote island and live among the people for several months, trying to become integrated into the tribe and accepted by them? Well, ethnographies and marketing are kind of like that, except instead of an Aboriginal tribe, it's a group of Harley Davidson riders or a suburban book club or people cleaning their bathrooms or cooking a Thanksgiving dinner. The idea behind ethnographies is that your customers are members of a culture that's alien and misunderstood by those outside the group. These outsiders include the marketing managers who are making decisions about the products and services they're trying to sell to this group. By treating your customers like members of an exotic culture, you're free to ask stupid questions and, hopefully, to see things in an entirely new light. I should stop at this point to emphasize, ethnography is not simply observation. Ethnography is known as participant observation. You're not just observing the tribe of consumers. You're trying to have that experience for yourself, to become a part of that tribe. A friend of mine who does this type of research refers to it as deep hanging out. One company that actively pursues this approach to research is Harley Davidson. Every year, top executives go on a 3-day ride-along with real, honest-to-goodness Harley Davidson customers. They travel with these bikers. They eat with them. They stay at the same hotels and watch them interact with their bikes and with each other. They try to, as best they can in 3 days' time, become a part of that tribe. To understand their consumers by becoming a customer, by living that experience for a short period of time. One of the insights that became apparent to management on these ride-alongs is the extent to which Harley-Davidson owners treat their bikes not just as possessions or even as showpieces, but almost as a valued and cared-for relationship partner. For example, after checking into a hotel, some Harley-Davidson riders would go to their rooms and immediately grab two washcloths, one wet and one dry, and then go back out to their bike. They would thoroughly, almost ritualistically, wipe the bike down before they would do anything else. Only after the bike was taken care of would they go back to the hotel room and unpack and get themselves ready for dinner. As a result of this insight, some dealerships now put bikes in a glass case when they're being serviced, so the owner can watch the mechanics fixing his pride and joy. It's strikingly similar to the way maternity wards are set up, to allow proud parents to look through the glass and watch the nurses attending their child. In addition to customer observations, focus groups, and ethnographies, there are a number of projective techniques that fit into this broad category of qualitative research. The basic theory behind projective techniques is that sometimes people are guarded in what they will tell you about a product, a brand, or an experience, and that asking indirect questions can sometimes reveal more about a person's true thoughts and feelings than you can get by asking them directly. There are various well-documented self-report biases that you run into when asking people directly about their own preferences or behavior. For example, one very expensive, decades-long health and nutrition survey had to be scrapped in 2014 because the survey relied on people self-reporting how much food they ate. After this data had been collected for years and used in various public health and nutrition studies, a different group of researchers went in and looked at the number of daily calories people were reporting and found that, if accurate, nearly all of the participants would have died long ago, starved to death. Whether because of self-presentation concerns or simple forgetfulness, people were dramatically underreporting the amount of food they were consuming, to the point that the food consumption data they were reporting was biologically impossible. Some of these self-reporting concerns can be reduced if you ask people not about their own behavior, but about the behavior of others. And that's where the projective techniques come in. We call them projective because you are essentially asking people to project their thoughts and feelings onto another person or to represent them in an unfamiliar medium. The simplest form of projective technique is to ask consumers what the typical consumer would think or feel or do in a particular situation. Very few people would be willing to admit that they overeat or that they neglect to floss every night. But many more would be willing to admit that the typical person does those things. We already talked about one example of this technique in our lecture on branding. I told you the story about Nescafe instant coffee in the 1950s. Recall that the research I told you about in that story didn't ask consumers about the brand directly. Instead, the researchers gave women in their target market one of two shopping lists and asked them to describe the person who made the list. The only difference across the list was the presence of either Maxwell House drip coffee or Nescafe Instant. The researchers could have just come right out and asked people what they thought of Nescafe. But if they had, people might have censored their responses. Sometimes people can be strangely reluctant to critique things directly. But ask them about a hypothetical person based on information that makes it harder to know what the researcher is really trying to get at. Well, surprisingly, people can really open up. Another fun example of a projective technique comes from my friend John Sherry at Notre Dame. He was teaching a class on qualitative methods, and one student group decided to research pet foods by interviewing dog owners in their homes about their pet food choices. They presented some of their initial findings to John, and he said, "Okay, that's good. Now go back and interview their dogs." Obviously, they thought John was crazy. But they tried it. They went back to those homes, and one of the students would get down on the floor with their tape recorder and ask the dog which type of food he liked. And an amazing thing happened. The dog owners who were standing nearby would answer in their best Scooby-Doo voices on behalf of their pets. Well, Sparky, what type of food do you like to eat?
Ruff, I like it very much. I love the real meat centers, ruff, ruff.
It was ridiculous. But they got a whole new set of insights from these pet owners who would open up and reveal more of their own thoughts by projecting their voices onto their dogs. Another, slightly less crazy, projective technique comes in the form of sitting your customers down in a room and giving them a stack of magazines. You then invite them to clip pictures from the magazines and make collages that represent a particular product or brand or experience. Once customers have projected their thoughts and feelings into this bizarre medium of clip art collage, you then go through the images and ask them what each means. The collage becomes a springboard for discussing ideas and feelings the consumer may not otherwise have been able to articulate. The data collected in this manner can be harder to interpret than a simple survey response. But there's also the chance that you'll find something radically new and innovative. But projective techniques need not rely on elementary school level arts and crafts projects in order to be effective. One of the pioneers of these types of projective techniques was Sidney Levy, who started publishing innovative and groundbreaking marketing research in the 1950s and continued well into the 2000s. Professor Levy once told me a story about being hired to consult for one of the branches of the U.S. military. As you probably know, when people sign up for the military in this country, they commit to a particular period of service. And then they have the option of leaving or of re-upping to continue for another period of time. The military goes to great lengths to get people with years of service to stay. They offer generous bonuses, more flexibility in where and how people serve, and so on. They know that this experienced group of trained specialists are very valuable. So they hired Professor Levy and another marketing professor to survey some of the servicemen and women to figure out what was driving their decision-making. What made some people decide to continue with service and others decide to go? So they conducted a pretty standard survey. They asked people to rate their agreement with various items, asked them to explain their decision-making. Then they added one more question. If this branch of the military were an animal, which animal would it be? When he told me this story, Professor Levy was very upfront about the fact he had no idea whether this question would yield anything interesting or not. But as it turned out, the answers were very interesting. People who ultimately agreed to re-up tended to compare the military to ferocious predators, lions, tigers, eagles, animals known for their bravery and fearsomeness. People who chose to leave the military chose work animals, beasts of burden, cows, donkeys, draft horses, animals that had to stand around a lot, carry things, and follow orders on pain of the lash. Professor Levy was even able to create a vitality index based on the type of animal each respondent chose. Now, this is not an example of using a projective technique to gain some radically different information that couldn't be acquired via other means. The survey answers they got were largely consistent with the results of the animal question. But the animal question was certainly more vivid and rich. I'd venture to say that hearing the animals people in those two different groups chose was probably more informative than several pages of charts and graphs would have been in terms of identifying how people felt and what was motivating their behavior. There are really no hard and fast rules for developing projective techniques. This is an opportunity to get creative. Think of new and different ways of getting people to project their opinions through indirect means. Ask them to compare brands in a category to animals. Ask them which brand they would vote for president or which they would want as a roommate. Ask them to describe the typical user of a product or service. The sky's the limit. And that concludes our Introduction to Marketing course. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Let me leave you with one final thought, courtesy of Hewlett-Packard co-founder David Packard. Marketing, he said, is too important to be left to the marketing department. And I believe that, sincerely. Many of the decisions made by people throughout the company, from human resources to accounting to finance to operations, have the potential to influence the value customers derive from their interactions with the company. And if people outside the marketing department don't know the marketing plan, what hope will they have of making smart decisions? Marketing insights should permeate the company. Everyone in an organization should be able to answer those three all-important questions. They should all know, who are our customers? What do they value? And how can our company's offerings be differentiated from the competition? People sometimes make marketing more complicated than it needs to be. It really just comes down to understanding your customers. No matter what you do in your organization, it's within your power to make customers happier by simply understanding what they really want. So here's my closing challenge to you. Use what you have learned in this course to go out and make some customers stay. Happy marketing, everyone.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are available online or via the free The Great Courses app for smartphones and tablets, available on the App Store or Google Play. View our full library at thegreatcourses.com. Or as always, you can call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.